You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective. What's left of
us? Welcome back. Today is Friday, January 15th. I'm Sam Moore.
And I'm Brent Holmes. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
It's 5:13 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
Up first, we have an interview with rock star photographer Dee Lippingwell, produced by News 101 correspondents Alice Tennant and Eva Eugen Singe. She talks about capturing the late David Bowie.
We also have News 101 co-director Rohit Joseph's interview with UBC political science professor Catherine Harrison on the BC government's opposition to the Kinder Morgan pipeline expansion project.
Following that, we have an interview with Vancouver Sun crime reporter Kim Boland, produced by News 101 correspondents Brent Holmes and Sam Moore. Hey, that's us.
Huh, look at that.
She gives her take on Sean Penn's Rolling Stone article on drug lord El Chapo Guzman.
To finish off the show, we have a special edition of News 101 financial reporter Alex Norman's weekly financial update.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, Joseph Boyden, Olav Slaymaker, Wade Davis, and Nassaf Gusab have all been named as members of the Order of Canada. Gusab is a professor of mathematics and previously a member of UBC's Board of Governors, who helped to found a number of research organizations. Davis is a professor of anthropology and a former explorer in residence for the National Geographic. Slaymaker is a professor emeritus of geography who currently researches climate change and cold environments, and Boyden is an award-winning author whose third book, named The Orenda, was the winner of the Canada Reads in 2014. Other UBC professors and alumni who have received the award include former Premier BC Mike Harcourt, environmentalist David Suzuki, and author Margaret Atwood. The Order of Canada is the second highest honor of merit in this country.
In local news, the Langara College is given a Musqueam name. Monday, Langara College was given a new Aboriginal name, Snowayith Laylum, which means House of Teaching in Musqueam. Langara President Lane Trotter recognized the importance of the name, saying, quote, "What we're looking for with this is making sure the duality we share is recognized. We are on Musqueam's unceded territory. We are Musqueam's college. We are Vancouver's college, and we need to reflect that." The new name is the result of efforts from Musqueam First Nation elders and Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson. Langara College has been searching for a new name as part of a reconciliation effort over the last 2 years. The new name was chosen by Musqueam elders, marking the first time a BC First Nation has given an Aboriginal name to a public post-secondary institution.
BCIT creates a nap room for students. The British Columbia Institute of Technology has opened a nap room for students looking to catch some sleep on campus. The initiative was a collaboration between BCIT Student Association and the school's Recreation Services Department. James Foran, the Student Association's communication manager, said that they wanted to offer students a space that would be more conductive to them being able to have a nap and recharge their batteries, then get back to school and continue on their workday. Students can book a one-hour nap free of charge between 12:30 to 5:30 p.m. on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. Beds and pillows are provided, and students even have access to lockers to store their bags in. So far, the nap room has been rapidly booked since it's launched and has received positive social media coverage. Foran said, quote, "Time will tell if it's all booked out all of the time or if it's something people can drop into when it works, but the students seem excited about it so far."
In national news, the Canadian dollar drops to 13-year low. The Canadian dollar and oil prices have both reached a 13-year low. The loonie dropped as low as 68.74 cents in Thursday's trading session. The Canadian dollar was last under 69 cents in April 2003. Bloomberg says this is the longest losing streak for the Canadian dollar since 1970. The dollar is expected to continue to fall. The price of crude oil has also dropped to $29.42 U.S. a barrel, compared to over $100 in the summer of 2014. Dan Farley, a regional investment strategist for the Private Client Reserve at U.S. Bank, said, quote, oil is the root cause of today. People are uncertain, and when they're uncertain, they're scared. The Canadian dollar is also down compared to the euro, the British pound, and the Japanese yen.
In international news, President Obama delivered his last State of the Union address on Tuesday. The president's speech reflected the state of the world, America's challenges, and reminded Americans that he can't solve their problems on his own. He also urged Americans to reject bigotry and Islamophobia and to make their voices heard through voting. Time magazine also released an article on the address called President Obama Puts Joe Biden in Charge of Curing Cancer. In his speech, Obama said, quote, I'm putting Joe in charge of mission control. For the loved ones we've all lost, for the family we can save, let's make America the country that cures cancer once and for all.
Charlie Hebdo draws criticism for controversial Alan Kurdi cartoon. Charlie Hebdo has come under fire for its latest cartoon. The French satirical publication ran a cartoon depicting a group of men chasing a young woman and Alan Kurdi, the drowned Syrian toddler, under the headline, Migrants. The text under the cartoon says, quote, what would have happened to little Alan if he grew up, a groper of women in Germany? Many believe the satirical magazine has gone too far and are outraged at the implication that all refugees are gropers. However, others claim the exaggeration is a common trope of French satire meant to mock those who hold these views rather than promoting them. The cartoon is in reference to the recent sexual assaults in Cologne, Germany on New Year's Eve. Cologne's police chief described the groups of men responsible as Arab or North African.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
The December-January double issue of Discorder is on the shelf of your favorite cafe, retailer, and record store now. Come take a tour through the alternative of the alternative coverage of Vancouver's music and art scenes with a resonant tapestry of Yusu, fairy travel with painted fruits, cybernetic interfacing at Dystopia Dreaming, Cuba-bound guitar gifting with Taxa, hovering in media arts with Gold Saucer, and getting lucky with our new Shinder app. We also feature the artwork of Graham Zirk and review albums for Umagma, TV Freaks, Young Galaxy, and more.
A special thank you to this month's sponsors, AMS Events, Audiopile, Caracol Records, Don't Argue Pizza, FSN Frank, Horses Records, Light Organ Records, LiveVan.com, Rickshaw Theatre, Rio Theatre, Sad Mag, Stormcrow Tavern, The Noise Floor, Vancouver Theatre Sports League, and Vinyl Records.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, an interview with photographer Dee Lippingwell, produced by News 101 correspondents Alice Tennant and Eva Yuguen-Senge. She talks about capturing the late David Bowie.
David Bowie, the Thin White Duke, Ziggy Stardust. After a private 18-month battle with cancer, Bowie died earlier this week on January the 10th, just 2 days after his 69th birthday. Tributes to the musician from fans and collaborators have been swarming the internet, just a small indication of the impact that he had on people's lives. Considered one of the most influential musicians of his era, five of Bowie's tours came to Vancouver between 1976 and 2004. Standing in the pit of some of those concerts was Dee Lippingwell, a photographer from Vancouver who has photographed music legends for over 40 years. Dee told us she had a great Bowie story from back in the day. We knew we had to hear it to get a picture of the artist and person that David Bowie was. In her book, First Three Songs, No Flash, Dee describes being the only Canadian photographer permitted backstage and feeling privileged to gain access to the usually private rock star's meet and greet. Here is Dee's terrifying encounter with the rock star in 1987 when his tour came through Vancouver.
As I had plenty of film and was in my usual gung-ho mood, I started taking pictures of everyone that Bowie met, sort of like the photos where you see the Queen shaking hands with celebrities. She never turns and smiles for the camera and doesn't seem to mind the flash, but every time my flash went off while Bowie was meeting these people, he would give me a piercing look, which I tried my hardest to ignore. Suddenly, I guess he couldn't stand it anymore and bolts from the line, walks up to me and wags his long bony finger in my face and says, "No more." And then he just glared at me and walked away. I guess I had just been fired. I could see him coming, right? But he wagged his finger in my face. It was like, you know, it was like, stop right now. I don't like this. He was a very private person.
But being told off wasn't Dee's first encounter with Bowie. Early in her career in 1977, Dee had been hired by the Georgia Strait to photograph Iggy Pop's Idiot World Tour when it came to Vancouver. Blondie was the opening act for the show.
And so I'm in Blondie's dressing room and, you know, watching them get ready. And Tom Harrison is there and, you know, he's trying to, you know, write a story about this new up-and-coming band. I walk out into the hall and I just stopped in my tracks and I went, you know, no, it can't possibly be. Oh, my God, that's David Bowie. No, it can't possibly be David Bowie. What on earth is he doing in Vancouver? Strange fascination fascinating me. Our changes are taking the pace I'm going through. Changes. One of the most iconic photos Dee took of David Bowie was from his 1990 Sound and Vision tour at the Pacific National Exhibition Coliseum. Deemed his greatest hits tour, Bowie was closing a chapter on his career, retiring his back catalogue in the mission to concentrate on new, fresh material for his future live performances. The photograph could have been taken anywhere, its dark background filled only by his tall, contrasting figure, a singular strobe light striking his cheekbones. Eyes closed, head turned, lips slightly parted, Bowie is lost in the music. So what is it like to photograph an artist like Bowie? Dee told us that out of all the legends she has photographed in her career, he was in her top 10. Just his genius. I think the first song that I heard was Major Tom, and that was just like, wow. Every time I turned around, he was putting something out that was like unique. You know, and that's what I look for in an artist. I don't like a lot of same stuff, right? And every time you put out a new tune, it would be like different. It was like, oh, okay, what's he gonna do this time, right?
Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. 7, 6. Commencing countdown, engines on. 3, 2. Check ignition and may God's love be with you.
Like many fans of rock and roll, Dee Lippingwell has been reflecting on what exactly has been lost in the world of music with the passing of David Bowie.
I mean, he'll always be around. We'll always have his music. His music will never go away. So, like anybody who passes away, you know, thank heaven that we had the opportunity, that I had the opportunity to see them, to photograph them, sometimes to meet them, he may be, you know, David may be gone. But he's never going to ever be forgotten, and he'll always have his music.
Thank you, Allison Eva. Now we have News 101 co-director Rohit Joseph's interview with UBC political science professor Catherine Harrison on the BC government's opposition to the Kinder Morgan expansion project.
My name is Catherine Harrison. I am a professor of political science.
Catherine, what was your gut reaction to this decision?
I would say that I was initially surprised, but that when I thought about it, less so, because really the province did take a similar position with respect to the Enbridge Northern Gateway. And, you know, on the issues of spill prevention and response, and the Premier has been very clear ever since then that these are the criteria, that they're applying them firmly, that they mean it. So the fact that the province hasn't received the reassurances that they've asked about, apparently repeatedly, would lead them to oppose the project in other ways shouldn't have been a surprise. It's consistent with what they've been saying all along.
So just how important was this decision by the provincial government?
I think it's very important in the sense that it is increasingly clear that the oil industry based in Alberta needs to find new markets for their exports. Particularly, the writing was already on the wall, but all the more so after President Obama rejected the Keystone XL project. The significance of the Trans Mountain expansion grew given the opposition to Enbridge Northern Gateway, and especially with the election of the Liberals and their commitment to a tanker ban on the North Coast, which, you know, seems to me to... I don't see how one can reconcile the Enbridge Northern Gateway project if there's a tanker ban. And so this is, you know, the live one, the one that is increasingly important and probably seemed most feasible given that there's already a pipeline there. There's already a route that, you know, for 50 years oil has been shipped along that existing pipeline. And Prime Minister Trudeau himself indicated conditional support for the Kinder Mountain expansion project. So this is the province is stating a position to the NEB. It's not a final position. It's still possible that they could be convinced. There's still the other conditions that the province set about BC getting its fair share of the benefits of the project, of appropriate consultation and accommodation with First Nations. So, you know, it's not the final straw by any means, but it makes it more difficult, I think, for the federal government to approve this project.
So is it even possible for the federal government to actually overrule the BC government on this decision?
You might want to check with, you know, constitutional environmental law type on that.
Okay.
My guess is that they probably can, because, under the Constitution, interprovincial works and undertakings is the term, but pipelines would qualify, are a matter of federal jurisdiction. International trade is a matter of federal jurisdiction, and ports and harbors are a matter of federal jurisdiction. So there's a lot of overriding federal jurisdiction here. I would think, there may be some issues where, there may be some provincial waters that could be affected, the Fraser River, for instance, that would give, that give the provincial government leverage as well, constitutional leverage, and they must have some of those. But for the most part, I would see this as pretty clear federal strong federal jurisdiction. But politically, even if the federal government has constitutional authority, using that authority to force a project on a provincial government, where the provincial government and a majority of the citizens living in that province oppose it, would be politically very challenging to do.
So was this decision by the provincial government, do you think, more of a result of public pressure and citizens really mobilizing? Or was there some other factors, like interests, that are at play here?
I don't know. Could have been either. It is, there are some important and legitimate questions about how to respond if there's a spill of diluted bitumen, which behaves differently than other oil spills. This is a proposal for a really large pipeline that would involve very big tankers going through Vancouver Harbor pretty much every day, you know, through a narrow channel. So there's lots of legitimate questions that one can ask, whether what, you know, really carried weight at the end of the day was the details or public concern. The premier is the one who would say, who would know.
And I have a last question that might be a bit demanding of you, in the sense, if you could place yourself in the shoes of Kinder Morgan now and see it from their perspective, what are their options to respond and actually, you know, get things done their way from henceforth? How would you adapt to the situation?
Well, there are the details of, you know, Kinder Morgan's got a lot of problems right now. They've got opposition from a provincial government that has set out 5 criteria. The province has been clear that they're not convinced on 2 of the criteria. They haven't said that they're necessarily satisfied with consultation and accommodation of First Nations and BC getting its fair share. It's just that that's not the business of the NEB review. So there's still lots of issues with satisfying the province of British Columbia. They've got citizens who have shown not just that they're opposed, but sufficiently opposed that they're, you know, willing to chain themselves to equipment and stand in front of bulldozers and that sort of thing. And, you know, if construction begins, I would have every expectation that civil disobedience would begin once again. But, you know, the immediate problem they've got is that Canadian oil is selling for less than $30 a barrel. The economic case that Trans Mountain submitted to the NEB for this pipeline was predicated on the price of oil steadily increasing, not immediately getting back up over $100, but heading in that direction. And it's gone in the other direction in just 3 or 4 months since that economic analysis was submitted. It's not clear to me whether this project is economically viable in the long term if we're in a world where the price of oil will remain low for a prolonged period. That's a big problem for Kinder Morgan. And that may be a bigger problem than the provincial government's concerns about oil spill and response.
Thank you, Rohit. We'll take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more news.
Conference record of 11-1, the UBC women's volleyball team is at 4th place in the Canada West League. Will they be able to keep up their run, extend their 2-game winning streak, and move up the standings? Or will they fall to the Brandon University Bobcats? Find out this Saturday on January the 16th on 5 p.m. on CanadaWest.ca with live commentary from the CITR sports team.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Now we have an interview with Vancouver Sun crime reporter Kim Boland, produced by News 101 correspondents Brent Holmes and Sam Moore. She gives her take on Sean Penn's Rolling Stone article on drug lord El Chapo Guzman.
We've got some slight technical errors going on, but Brent and I can talk about this at a bit, seeing as we produced it. So, Brent, what was the gist of what Kim Bolin had to say about Sean Penn's?
I think the gist of what she had to say about it was that doing an interview with someone like El Chapo requires a lot of tact and a lot of diplomacy, and really is something that if you're going to go in and do it, as Sean Penn did, you need to be very diplomatic about it. But I think we have it ready to go now, so we'll cut to that interview now.
Good stuff.
Okay, so what was your first reaction when you heard that Sean Penn was interviewing El Chapo?
Well, like everyone, I was pretty surprised and somewhat fascinated. I mean, it's a really interesting story. When I actually read his article in Rolling Stone, I was, very disappointed. There was very little insight into the man we call El Chapo and his decades of drug trafficking and links to many, many murders, including those of journalists in Mexico. So I was really let down by the quality of the article.
Can you walk us through what you were thinking as you were going through that article? I know it was like 10,000 words long.
Well, as I read and read and read, I think the first thing that occurred to me was just how little information there was about El Chapo and about the murderous cartels of Mexico, period. It was very much a travelogue that had a lot more to do with kind of highlighting what Sean Penn was doing. I felt it was a bit self-aggrandizing. And, it was interesting. I still read it, as did many, many people. But, as a journalistic endeavor, I wasn't very impressed.
Right. The article received quite a bit of negative attention online. Why do you think this is?
Well, I mean, journalism is something that those of us who do it take very seriously. Mm-hmm. If you look at a country like Mexico, there are so many journalists who are risking their lives every day to expose corruption, to write about the cartels and the way the cartels have, controlled institutions in that country. Dozens have lost their lives or been disappeared over the last 10 years. Some of those disappearances are right in Sinaloa and are believed to be linked to the cartel that El Chapo heads. So, the idea that a Hollywood star would use his money and resources to kind of go down there and party with El Chapo, because that's mostly what he did, it's really disturbing to those of us who want to defend the practice of journalism and the people that are doing it at great risk to themselves.
Yeah, you mentioned that Sean Penn's a kind of movie star and not a journalist. Who should have been writing that kind of article?
Well, I've read a lot of things in recent days written by Mexican journalists who are on the front line there. And, it's not really for me to speak for them, but I certainly will quote the things that I have read. They're saying that they get offered interviews with cartel leaders all the time, and they usually decline them because they come with so many strings attached. I'm paraphrasing, of course. And in fact, that, when you do have these meetings with cartel leaders or people that are high up in organized crime there, they're often not voluntary. Journalists are forced to attend them. And they're also, in essence, told that if they write things that the cartel or the organized crime group doesn't like, they will face consequences. And they know those consequences are serious and usually involve violence or, in worst-case scenarios, death. So when journalists are working under those circumstances, it's not really appropriate for someone from the outside, whether it's me as a Canadian journalist or a Hollywood star like Sean Penn, to fly down there and undermine what those people are trying to accomplish by refusing to meet with some of those cartel people.
Much of the criticism that has been levied against this article is based around breaches in journalist ethics. How would you describe the kind of violations of journalism ethics that you see in this article?
Well, the first one that struck me and struck all of my colleagues was the fact that he gave El Chapo the right to edit the story, before it was published. And, maybe Sean Penn doesn't really understand how that is, in essence, a sacred rule in journalism. You don't give the subjects the right to view the story or edit the story before it's published or broadcast. You just can't do that. Bad enough that he gives the person that right. But, this is someone who's linked to many, many murders. You know, so it's the type of person he's given carte blanche to that is particularly upsetting to journalists. Now, Rolling Stone does know those rules, and Rolling Stone has been caught in its own journalistic controversies, you know, with the false rape story that was published last year. So you'd think that they would be really careful not to breach what are considered normal journalistic ethics. And yet, you know, Rolling Stone also agreed to that criteria for the interview, that El Chapo would have final say as to what was published. And they seem to think, well, it was good enough that he didn't make any changes. Well, what if he had made changes, you know? It just isn't acceptable in any circumstance. And the other thing that is really, I think, drawing a lot of criticism from journalists is the fact that he wasn't asked any difficult questions. You know, it was a real softball interview. I've heard some people defend him, say, oh, well, there's softball interviews done by journalists in North America all the time. That may be true, you know, in a political setting, but it's not when you're dealing with a mass murderer or someone who's, you know, a major organized criminal. So, you know, that was also quite upsetting. You know, and then the biggest irony of all, it looks like, you know, Penn inadvertently led El Chapo's captors right back to him, right? So, you know, and that's something that to me really strikes at the naivety that Penn showed when he went to do that interview.
So if you had to interview El Chapo or somebody like El Chapo, what would you have done?
Well, I can only really talk about my own experiences. I do cover gangs and organized crime here in Canada. Mm-hmm. You know, I have had threats because of the work that I do. I have interviewed people who've admitted that they've been involved in murders. And what I have to do is ask them very hard questions about exactly what role they had in, you know, these events, these criminal events. Because, you know, people who reach out to journalists usually want to whitewash their own history. In this case, we know that El Chapo wanted a movie made about him, and that's why he was willing to meet with the Hollywood star, who apparently he didn't know of a month before the meeting. You know, we've learned from some of the text messages that have surfaced in the Mexican media. So you have to ask hard questions. You have to prepare and know the history in that country. If I were to go down there, and, you know, obviously many journalists would be fascinated to have an interview with El Chapo, but the first thing I would do is talk to my Mexican colleagues to find out, you know, what the pros and cons of doing such an interview would be. I would ask them, you know, if you had this opportunity, what would you ask him? What do you think I should ask him? And maybe liaise with people who are on the ground in that country living under that terrible threat to make sure that I'm not stepping on toes, right? I think it's bad enough when journalists from North America, you know, parachute into places, you know, and on very, you know, short notice, you know, try and, you know, tell a complicated story to people in other parts of the world. We do that, but we also need to respect the work that's going on the ground by local journalists. And, you know, if I'm ever out of country on assignment, I always try to do that, to work closely with local journalists. So I think that would be my first priority if I ever had the opportunity to do such an interview.
Last, you mentioned earlier Rolling Stone having to retract their Rape on Campus article. Given the controversy we've seen over this article, do you think they'll have to do another retraction?
No, I don't think there's anything to retract. It is what it is, you know, and, you know, some people have said, look, I found it quite fascinating because it told me more about Sean Penn and his view of himself than it did about El Chapo, but they still found it to be an interesting read. You know, I didn't find it to be that interesting because I was looking for the meat of the actual subject, but no, I don't see that there would be anything to retract. They've explained their rationale in allowing him to have final say over what was published. I didn't agree with them, but I mean, it is something that's up for journalistic debate for sure. I think we may see more journalism done on, you know, what happens next, right? Will Penn be forced to testify, as one of El Chapo's lawyers has asked? You know, he says if our guy goes to trial, particularly in the U.S., they want Penn to come as a witness because they're ironically refuting some of the things that are in his article. So I don't think we've heard the last of it by any stretch, but I don't think there will be the need for any kind of retraction.
Okay. Kim, thank you so much for doing this interview.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, us.
Good job, us.
So we've got another set of PSAs to hold you over, and then we'll be back.
17th is Art's birthday. To commemorate this momentous occasion, CITR will be transmitting 24 hours of radio art. Put on your art party hat and celebrate with artists all over the world by tuning into 101.9 FM in Vancouver or CITR.ca. From midnight to midnight, audio experimentation and sonic subversion, 24 hours of radio art, Sunday, January 17th on CITR.
All right. To finish off the show, we have a special weekly financial report with News 101 senior financial correspondent Alex Norman and Natalie Dakers, president and CEO of AccelerX.
This is the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets. These are this week's top stories. Goldman Sachs reaches a $5 billion settlement over mortgage securities. Macy's to cut jobs and shut stores due to weak holiday sales. Canadian Tire adds 33 types of Christmas lights to its safety recall. And Suncor and Cenovus pledge backing for BC clean technology sector. We begin today's news that Goldman Sachs on Thursday had reached an agreement to resolve a long-running government investigation into the sale of residential mortgage bonds in the run-up to the financial crisis. The total settlement is just over $5 billion and will include $1.8 billion in consumer mortgage relief. Goldman Sachs officials said the consumer relief will include write-downs for homeowners who are behind on their mortgage payments, as well for financing for affordable housing. Goldman Sachs is one of the last banks to reach a settlement with the government over the financial crisis. In August of 2014, Bank of America agreed to pay $16 billion in settlements with the government. And JP Morgan Chase reached a $13 billion settlement over the mortgage bond fiasco in late 2013. Shares in Goldman Sachs were down today, closing at $155.61 for a 3.85% loss on the day. Investors rally on news of Macy's deep cuts. Macy's Inc. said it will eliminate more than 2,000 jobs and consolidate operations after reporting weak holiday sales, highlighting a downturn in the apparel demand. The department store officials blamed the unusual warm weather for discouraging consumers from purchasing sweaters, coats, and gloves. It also blames the strong dollar for keeping tourists from visiting the United States. The company's shares rose 2.8% in after-hours trading on Wednesday as investors reacted positively to Macy's plan to reduce costs by about $400 million. Shares for Macy Inc. were up today, closing at $37.87, with a 0.61% gain for the day. You might want to get those Christmas lights checked out. Canadian Tire is expanding a recall on Christmas lights it sold under the Holiday Collection brand for safety reasons. Health Canada says it received one report of a consumer who received minor electrical shocks from the colored lights. The agency also said that the affected lights may pose a fire hazard. The recall includes 33 types of holiday collection lights sold by Canadian Tire after August 1st of this year. This is in addition to 12 types identified 2 weeks ago. You can check a complete list on Health Canada's website, healthycanadians.gc.ca. The recall does not include Noma lights, which are another brand carried by the national retailer. Shares in Canadian Tire were down today, closing at $105.80 with a 1.69% loss. Green is in for 2016. Two of Canada's biggest oil sand companies are pledging support for British Columbia's clean technology sector. This comes as the province refuses to back a major pipeline to the west coast of Canada. Suncor Energy Inc. and Cenovus Energy Inc. have committed as much as $100 million over the next 10 years to a Vancouver-based Ewok Innovations New Venture Capitalism Fund. It is designed to accelerate development of technologies that reduce the energy industry's environmental footprint and risk of oil spills. The move comes days after BC said it could not support the $6.8 billion Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion. Government sources say that the U.S.-based Kinder Morgan Inc. had not provided sufficient details about its spill response capabilities. In other news, markets were down across the board. Toronto's S&P TSX Composite Index fell 2.13% to close at 12,073 points. The broader S&P 500 index was down today with a loss of 2.16% to close at 1,880 points. The Nasdaq closed lower today with a loss of 3.09%. In the European markets, the German DAX was down today 2.54%. In the Asian indices, markets were also down as the Japanese Nikkei posted a loss of 0.54% and the Shanghai Composite was down as well with a loss of 3.55%. In the commodities market, the February gold futures closed up 1.38% for $1,088 an ounce of gold, while the February crude futures were down today 5% to close at $29.70 a barrel. In natural gas, February future contracts were down 1.8% to close at $2.10 a unit. In the bond market, yields for 10-year Canadian bonds are currently at 1.153%. U.S. 10-year Treasury yields closed lower today at a rate of 2.034%. This has been the weekly Financial Update Report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets.
Thank you, Alex. Quick correction there. That was just a regular broadcast of the Financial Report and not an interview. But that's our program for today. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or email us at news@citr.ca.
You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website at citr.ca/radio/news-101. You can also find great content on our SoundCloud page. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Sam.
And I'm Brent. Today's broadcast was produced by Alberto Montilla. For the entire team at CITR, thank you for listening.
Stay tuned for Lady Radio from the Women's Collective right here on CITR 101.9 FM. To close off the show, we have Night Games by Room. Their album, It Takes a Lot to Show Up, is number 7 on this week's Top 30 at CITR.
Yeah.